March the 14th, 2023 marked 100 years since four men were executed by a firing squad at Drumbo, Stranorder. They would be known as the Drumbo Martyrs. In this, the last installment in this series, to mark the decade of centenaries, Caroline Carr, assistant curator with Donegal County Museum, takes us through the journey of the men from what led to their arrest and their subsequent death.
That starts with the Anglo-Irish Treaty. So we know the War of Independence began in 1919, but as the war progressed and deaths mounted on both sides, moves were made to establish a truce. So the ceasefire began on 11 July 1921, and then after the Anglo-Irish Treaty, setting up the new Irish Free State was signed on the 6th December in London. The outcome of that was Northern Ireland remained in existence, but a boundary commission was to be established to review the border, or where the border was located. And then Ireland would have the same rights as other dominions, but an oath of fidelity to the king would have to be taken by all members of the Parliament. And most people were in favour of the treaty, as it offered an end to the terrible violence during the War of Independence. PJ Ward, who was a Sinn Féin MP for Donegal South, said at the treaty debates in the Dáil, he said, "At Christmas, every Sinn Féin club debated this treaty amongst themselves. The Sinn Féin clubs, by 17-3, asked that this treaty be ratified under protest, and they stated they could see no alternative." So on the 7th of January 1922, at the Dáil meeting, the treaty was passed by 64 votes to 57. So the Anglo-Irish Treaty was accepted. So then, to figure out why these men from Kerry and Cork and County Derry ended up in Donegal as well, is during early 1922, there was many press reports and reported all over the world that a triangular patch of land between the counties of Donegal and Fermanagh was known as the Pettigo and Baileach Salient. The majority of Baileach lies in County Fermanagh, with part of it crossing over the River Erne into Donegal, where the Baileach Fort, or the Battery Fort, overlooks the village. So during this period, Baileach was only accessible by road from elsewhere in Fermanagh and Northern Ireland by crossing through County Donegal and the then Free State. So as a result of this isolation and the wider unrest in the area, the RIC moved out of abandoned Baileach in April 1922. A result of that, the local IRA had taken control of Baileach. So in April 1922, it's a strategically important decision by the Irish government to place army garrisons on the Donegal side of the two divided villages, which was Pettigo and Baileach. And we know as Pettigo was split in two as well. You go across the bridge and you're in Northern Ireland. Following the withdrawal of the RIC, this is before they established the Gather Síochána, so it was a lawless time, and it was also prevent any British attempt to take over these parts of County Donegal as well. So after the treaty, to prevent a permanent split in the IRA, Michael Collins and Liam Lynch agreed in a joint military strategy, which included using IRA forces to attack the newly established Belfour government in Northern Ireland. It's what is known as the Northern Offensive. So IRA volunteers were sent up from strongholds in County Kerry and County Cork, and it was bolstered by those who fled into the west from Tyrone, Derry and Belfast, who were trying to avoid internment. So they relocated into the counties of border Northern Ireland, including Donegal. One of the major events in our military history was between the 27th of May and the 8th of June 1922, the villages of Pettigo and Baileach became the location of the largest military engagement between pro and anti-treaty forces, the Ulster Special Constabulary, known as the B Specials, and the British Army. And this was significant because it was the last time the pro and anti-treaty forces fought side by side. It's an extraordinary picture of them at Finner Camp, and you can see they're, you know, they're quite a raggle-taggle bunch, and we had a large, huge, large-scale picture, and you can identify all the different types of weapons they use, from sawn-off shotguns to rifles to Martini Henrys to anything they probably had robbed or got their hands on. So on the 27th of May, in response to the ongoing IRA activity in the region, a force of B Special arrived by boat and commandeered Marinamina Castle outside Baileach. Following this, there were forced retreat following a major gun battle. So then the pro and anti-treaty forces in Pettigo began digging in as they came under fire from the British military on the Fermanagh side of the village. And with petition from the Northern Ireland government, Winston Churchill sanctioned British troops based in Enniskillen to organise artillery attacks against the IRA in Baileach and Pettigo. And by coincidence, Winston Churchill knew Pettigo really well. He has visited his Leslie cousins at their summer residence, the beautiful big house which recently renovated on the main street. So he knew Pettigrew very well. And then on the 1st of June, a combined force of British troops from the 18th Infantry Brigade, supported by the RIC and the B Special, approached Pettigrew by road. So air cover, which most people don't think it's a modern invention, but air cover was provided by an RAF squadron as well. So over the next few days, various attacks and forays took place. So on the 4th of June, several armoured cars drove through a barricade and moved up Main Street. And at this time, Special Constable Dawson was killed by a sniper. So on the Irish side, we had Patrick Flood, Bernard McKenney and William Kearney were killed during the ensuing battle. William Deasley died later of wounds in the Donegal workhouse, and many more injured men were evacuated to the workhouse in Donegal for treatment in the infirmary there. And you can see it in their records as well that they're listed as the IRA volunteers. The British took over the village then and arrested the remaining men. Many of the inhabitants fled to Lough Derg, County Donegal and County Fermanagh due to ongoing sniping and other military actions. So on the Sunday morning of the 4th of June 1922, detachments of the British Army, including two companies each from the 1st Battalion, Lincolnshire Regiment, and 2nd Battalion, South Staffordshire Regiment, supported by a section of howitzers, moved quickly to occupy the Donegal village of Pettigrew and the surrounding area. So over the next several months, units of the British Army, aided by local civilian committee, established and administered a military zone in the Pettigrew area. And this marked the only occasion since the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty when part of the Irish state was occupied without the consent of the Irish government by an external power. So following the beginning of the Civil War, settlement talks were ongoing between Dublin and London governments and involved the Bishop of Clogher and the Dean Keown, the Prior of Lough Derg, which agreed to create a neutral zone where no arms were allowed to be carried apart from soldiers, and in disputed area controlled by the regular British Army. So we had in January 1923, finally, the British Army withdrawn from the Irish side of Pettigrew. Irish officials, along with the Guards, Irish Free State Army, came in to fill the vacuum, to take over command of the Irish side of Pettigrew.
And that was obviously hugely significant at the time, after all,
being occupied by a British force was extraordinary. A lot of the Catholic population had fled, and a lot of the Protestant population had fled before that. So it was a real mix in the town, and there was a kind of uneasy, unsettled kind of peace at the time, and there was always worry that there was still going to be trouble.
Yeah, they were worrying, yeah. Is this going to last? Or
yes, or was there going to be something else going to happen to it? So after the Battle of Pettigrew, on the 6th of June then, we had the IRA abandoning Bleak Fort. As you remember, it's on the Donegal side, and the majority of local residents began to leave or evacuate out. So on the 8th of June, the British forces entered the village of Bleak and captured the fort, raising the Union flag. And then, as I said, it was on the Donegal side of the border, its occupation was contrary to the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and the justification back from the British government was that it was on grounds of strategic necessity. Most people don't realise that it was occupied until it was handed back to Free State Fort in August 1924, which is an extraordinary time. So most people realise we were occupied that long, yeah, by the British. Tiny little part of Donegal, as you can see when you're driving into Bleak. So we know that the Northern Defences brought men from Cork and Kerry, Donegal.
Much as outlined has happened in Donegal up to this point, where we are now about to enter the era of the Civil War.
On the 16th of January 1922, following the ratification of the treaty, the British give the control to Dublin Castle to the Provisional Free State Government. So then on the 14th of April, anti-treaty forces then took control of the forecourts in Dublin. I remember we know the infamous battle and the subsequent fire as well, destroying lots of valuable genealogical records and other records as well. In June then, we had the general election, and the first general election we had as an Irish Free State was a decisive vote for the treaty. So the treaty was accepted widely. On the 28th of June then, under the threat of hostilities from the British government, as I said, the Free State force attacked the forecourts and erupted. And it's interesting that the howitzers that were used in the Battle of Pettigrew were some of those used by the Irish soldiers then. They were abandoned by the British and they were reused in the attack on the forecourts. And there's extraordinary footage as well available from the Battle of Petticoat Bleakin. You can see the British soldiers marching up into places, and you can see the howitzers being put in place as well and firing as well. And they're the actual guns that were used then in the forecourts. Yeah. Irish using them against the Irish. So then in Donegal, pro-treaty forces soon had control of our county, but not without some resistance from pockets of anti-treaty forces. So on 27 September 1922, emergency legislation known as the Public Safety Bill was passed by the Dáil. And this allowed for the execution of those captured bearing arms against the state. Legislation gives the National Army powers of punishment for anyone taking part or aiding and abetting attacks on national forces, having possession of arms or explosives without a proper authority, or disobeying an army general order. And then military courts had the right to impose capital punishment, which was a sentence of death or imprisonment or penal servitude, on those found guilty. The war was bankrupting the new Irish state as well. They were left in a precarious position that the coffers were running dry, maintaining the war.
That was real drastic.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, because like the British had left and all the administration, they handed over, and then people weren't paying their income tax, or some systems weren't set up yet to generate income into government coffers. So then the anti-treaty IRA chief staff was Liam Lynch, and he had decided the tactics changed from large-scale military confrontation to instead guerrilla tactics of concentrating on destroying infrastructure of government by targeting like income tax offices, road and rail lines, and also government buildings. And this was kind of hit and run kind of manoeuvres. So with the result, government forces found it very difficult to react and to counteract as well, because we weren't sure where next was going to be hit, because there were small pockets of, they weren't large.
You can just imagine the whole country
They're broken up to little pockets kind of flying or on the run as well. So the threat of executions then was intended as a means of persuading the anti-treaty forces to call off their campaign. By the beginning of 1923, many of the anti-treaty followers were under arrest. There was also a lack of support from the general public for the anti-treaty forces. So it became clear that there was no hope of winning at that stage.
And then Donegal kind of became a real hive for the anti-treaty.
In the end of the country, yes. So in October, we go back to 1920, during the War of Independence. So Charlie Daly from County Kerry had been appointed the full-time IRA organiser responsible for counties Tyrone and rural County Derry, not Derry City. He went home and recruited volunteers from Kerry to join the Northern Offensive. And among them was Daniel Enright and Timothy Sullivan. There was a split then. Daly did not support the treaty and became anti-treaty. And by mid-1922, he was a deputy officer commanding of the 1st and 2nd Northern Divisions, anti-treaty forces in County Donegal.
So he would have been up here that whole time.
He stayed up the whole time. And then he was, you know, in the War of Independence. And then when the treaty, he rejected the treaty and split as well. As the Civil War progressed, he approached the anti-treaty HQ in Dublin, saying, we had something, and people don't realise there's very little of the anti-treaty force in Donegal. People assume there's thousands of them, but there wasn't. And as Charlie Daly reported to the anti-treaty HQ in Dublin, we had something over 100 men at the start. Some of them were spies and traitors. In the course of a few weeks, we're left with only 30 men, and nearly all of them were strangers to the county. So he means people from Southern Ireland and in from Northern Ireland as well. So
and
very
even that
few
would have been difficult for their operation, even knowing the geographical.
Of course, and then, you know, and they would stand out as strangers.
Yeah.
You know, with their accents, you know, especially from Cork and Kerry, they would be recognisable easily that they weren't locals as well. On the 16th of July 1922, Shanahan, officer commanding of the anti-treaty forces in Donegal, decided to abandon their HQ, which was in Glenveagh Castle, to clear it out because they were coming under threat from the pro-treaty forces. So they began to form flying columns, which were the hit-and-run attacks, and they would stay on the run. They wouldn't have a base, and they'd just go from place to place while carrying out manoeuvres. The pro-treaty forces were in constant pursuit, so the anti-treaty forces couldn't spend any longer than a night in an area because of hostility to them as well. And there was very few, you know, safe houses or welcoming houses. Maybe they, you know, they weren't close to each other. So
that must have been very difficult for them.
For conditions, yeah, because Charlie Daly mentions, you know, going into houses and, you know, you imagine men arriving to your house at night and like knocking the door, and you'd have to let them in and you have to feed them. And he talks about the county being assuredly poor. And like he was very grateful to get some potatoes and salt. And he saw the conditions. People were very poor and living in poor conditions. And then especially like now in 1922, 23, there was a famine going on in West Donegal. The people don't realise. And, you know, some of the descriptions are the same as famine conditions back in the Garth of Moher. Terrible conditions. Also, the weather conditions at that time was really wet. It was terrible, terrible weather conditions as well.
And with them travelling the around, run, they wouldn't have been carrying many clothes or anything.
No, and then they only could spend one night in a place to move on. You know, you couldn't get your clothes dry, couldn't get your boots dry. They probably might not have had changes of clothes. And people might not have anything to give them or anything to take off them as well. They actually forced them to all split into about three groups at the time. Two groups of 20 men were sent to operate in West and North East Donegal. And Shanahan led the other 40 or so men to South Donegal. So at the beginning of November, Anti-Treaty HQ in Dublin ordered the forces to evacuate Donegal because they knew that there's no hope of winning, no hope of continuing the campaign. Lehan sent out a dispatch to Daly and he said, "I've received an order from Ernie O'Malley authorising us to leave Donegal at once and withdraw our men. I believe our work here is impossible. In order that we may try and make arrangements, could you please bring your lads towards Drumkeen?" And you know Drumkeen is outside Letterkenny and, you know, it's far from West Donegal. "And we'll go to that length to meet you. We'll be able to talk things over there. Until I see you and the lads, good luck." So Charlie Daly was at that time in West Donegal and he decided to remain. And his column decided to remain for whatever reasons. And over in West Donegal, that's where Joseph Sweeney was from, Burton Port, on Pro Treaty Ground. So it's an unusual thing to, you know, to stay in West Donegal and he, instead of trying to come towards Drumkeen to get picked up.
And obviously he'd be cutting off all support then.
Yes, because they were told they were all evacuating. So they had no backup. They were on their own. So there was. So on the evening of the 2nd November, Charlie Daly and the rest of his flying squad came over the hill from Gorahork, over the mountains. So they arrived at two houses, I mean, in Wheel in Dunluey, and they were so dead on their feet they'd forgot to post a lookout. Not long after, soldiers acting on a tip-off from the day before arrived. So you have to remember, this is in the evening time, but I suppose it would be about 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. They were travelling miles on that day and there was a tip-off because you have to remember the forces had to come from the HQ in Drumbo. And you have to remember, roads were not anything like this. So it took quite a while. So there's discussion about the tip-off. Was it that day? But it's more than likely it was the night before or the day before or things like that, because it would take a while to get the forces on the road because they arrived in lorries to gather them. So they arrived on a tip-off and they surrounded two houses, John and Frank Jarkey's, and went into the houses. So they arrested Charlie Daly, Timothy O'Sullivan and Daniel Enright off from Kerry. Shan or Jack Larkin, he was the officer commanding of the South Derry Brigade. James Donaghy from County Derry. Daniel Coyle, Cololt, Fulcairn. He's very interesting because his sister was Ethna Coyle. And then Frank, or known as Francis Ward from Moreau, just between Fulcairn and Dunfanaghy. And Jim Lane from County Cork. So Dennis Houston, an officer, he was one of the arresting party. He described the scene.
"I saw Francis Ward and Daniel Coyle, both of whom I recognised in the kitchen, and three other men who were strangers to me. They were put under arrest, and then the soldiers proceeded to another room off the kitchen. A man opened the door of the room, whom I recognised as Charlie Daly. He was put under arrest, and he immediately stated that he accepted responsibility for all of his men arrested, and that he was in charge."
The men had been travelling on foot for days across Donegal in the lead-up to their capture in tiresome conditions. Could this have led to the slight slip in awareness that ultimately resulted in their arrest?
The territory that they would have to cover to get to Drumkeen would have been just bog and mountain and it had been very difficult. And been very difficult not to be spotted either as well. A band of men over the hill, especially if they were travelling during the day, you know, people would notice them. And also they were being looked for as well. They were being chased. And then Joe Sweeney also said that at times too, he knew where they were. So there was somebody who knew where they were of the time, so whoever that was.
We travel now to Drumbo, where the name Drumbo Martyrs originates from. It was to be the last place the four men travelled to.
So on the 4th of November in 1922, a special message was sent from the pro-treaty forces in Drumbo Castle, and it was sent to the HQ at Beggar's Bush in Dublin, and it stated that a flying column of regulars were captured in Wheel, Dunluey on Tuesday night, second instance, by troops operated from Glenveagh Castle under Lieutenant Commandant McBrearty. Charles Daly, late Officer Commanding 2nd Northern Division, was in charge. He was acting as Deputy Officer Commanding 1st and 2nd Northern Divisions, a regular. So on the 30th of November, a court-martial, because remember they were arrested by the military, so they were under military law and they were classed as soldiers, was held at Drumbo Castle in Stranraer. So the military court panel was made up of prosecutor Mr. Cunningham, the deputy divisional commandant Joe Sean McLaughlin, and state solicitor William McMenamin, and commandant Tom Glennon, divisional adjutant.
They were obviously there a long time already at this stage.
Yeah, so that was, they were arrested on the 4th of November. They're there about a month or so, but it probably wasn't very unusual because they had to set up probably to organise the military panel and maybe to get evidence and to make sure the witnesses and everything was there to be set as well and give a chance for any evidence or anything like that too. See, there was other people being held in Drumbo Castle as well, so there was probably maybe other courts or other court-martials occurring before that as well. And this one is a major event as well because six were charged. Each charge would be in possession of three rifles, a revolver, 300 rounds of .302 ammunition, six rounds of .45 ammunition, and a German egg bomb without proper authority. So two others were charged with being in possession of three rifles, three revolvers, three bandoliers of .303 ammunition, and a pouch of .45 ammunition with proper authority. So the outcome was all were found guilty. There was no other outcome. They were found in possession. And also a cap of a Free State soldier with his name written inside was found. And it was taken from a soldier in a Free State soldier. So evidence was found as well that they were involved in previous attacks. On the 18th of January then, in 1923, the court-martial continued, but no sentence was passed down. So the six men remained under threat of execution as under the Stand Clear Order in January 1923, anyone who attempted any way to murder any person would face the death penalty. So then we had during February rumours that death sentence would be imminent spread through the county. So Donegal County Council and Dunfanaghy Rural District Council discussed this. But the local government inspector stated the rumours were untrue. And you can read actually in the minutes. And this is the first time I've ever seen it. And this, you have to remember, this is 19. It writes, this is fake news. So this is the first,
it wasn't Donald Trump.
And it's not. So this, this is fake news. It's untrue.
So would they have believed that?
They believed that they were under the threat of execution, but no sentence had been carried out.
Right.
So it was highly unlikely that they were going to be executed.
Right.
But it's just really interesting. And you can see it in the county council minutes that it says, this is fake news.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Like, so it's not a new phrase. And sorry, Donald, you're not the first to use it. So in February then, Timothy Sullivan wrote to Helena Kelleher in Tralee, County Kerry. And in his letter, he wrote, nothing strange here, only that we were court-martialed on the 18th of January. We've got no account of it since. We're happy as the flowers in May.
And it was all to change.
All changed at 1:40 p.m. on the 11th of March 1923. A radio message was sent from Drumcastle to the General HQ in Dublin, reporting that Captain Bernard Cannon killed in Creasla Post last night, particulars later. And this was Captain Cannon, who's based in Creasla Barracks. There was a shootout, and unfortunately, Captain Cannon was shot through the skylight in the door. And it's talked about later, you know, there's nobody who claimed it. Father Donald stated that in much later when he was talking to Ernie O'Malley, when he's been interviewed in the late 1940s, and with Joe Sweeney as well, that there was no IRA or anti-treaty force in the area at the time. Father Sullivan mentions too that it was a fair day. So there's a lot of rowdiness and drunkenness going on. And before that, there was men arrested. So nobody claimed responsibility for the action of killing Captain Bernard Cannon. But the return message from GHQ was an order to execute four men, including Larkin from Derry. So then Joseph Sweeney reported and back came an order. He sent it back again to query it and came an order to execute four men, one of them Larkin. So he sent back a wireless message back again for confirmation because he thought it couldn't be true. The same message came back later. So then he tried again to see was the message or could it be changed. Then I sent a message direct to the Adjutant General, Garage O'Sullivan. Larkin's name came back again. Larkin was from six counties and I didn't want to shoot a man from the six counties. He also states he was very fond of Charlie Daly.
While the arrested man could not have physically been involved in the attack in Creasla, the fear was that other anti-treaty forces were still in operation in Donegal. Therefore, the call was made for their execution.
The consequences of the attack at Creasla had seriously consequences for those men captured, and especially for Charlie Daly because he was the officer commanding as well. Mm-hmm. And he was the prize catch, you know, for being arrested in the county. So remember, this was on the 11th of March, but as late as Sunday, the 12th of March, Timothy Sullivan wrote again to a fellow Republican who had been arrested in a stole, and he said, we were court-martialed here on the 18th of January. The charge was unlawful possession of arms, and we've heard no count about it since. So they were completely in the dark. Mm-hmm. So behind the scenes, obviously, Joe Sweeney was trying to, you know, confirm it, and hopefully, possibly, that her message from GHQ would change. But unfortunately, at 4 p.m. on Monday, the 13th of March, Daly, O'Sullivan, Enright and Larkin were informed that they would be executed the next morning. So late on Monday the 13th, when the news broke, Dr. Charles O'Sullivan, Bishop of Kerry, who happened to be a cousin of Charlie Daly's, contacted Bishop O'Donnell, Bishop of Raphoe, Patrick O'Donnell, to ask him to intervene on behalf of the condemned men. And Bishop O'Donnell later wrote in letters to a fellow priest, he said, "When the news reached me late the evening before, I managed after hours to make telegraphic communications with Dublin that to go down and open the post office up, especially to, because remember the telephone exchange, you know, to get somebody there to operate the calls to put them through to Dublin. And it took a while. You know, it's not like nowadays your call connects automatically.
Yeah.
There's only so many lines and you had to wait to get a call connected, because remember people had to, you know, wait years ago to book a call. This is before even more modern exchange in Letterkenny. So he said, "I sent the most earnest representations against the executions." And he sent these communications to Richard Mulcahy, Minister of Defence at the time, but they were unsuccessful.
And a bishop intervening at that time, yeah, was huge.
A big deal, yeah. Yes. No, serious, because it was because the anti-treaty force were being condemned from the altar. And you have instances of anti-treaty men going to Mass and the priest condemning them from the altar. So they were leaving Mass, mm-hmm. you know, and they were being cast out and, you know, they were being spoken against and condemning what actions they were doing. So this was an extraordinary turn of action, yeah. for the bishop. But he was unsuccessful. And he also sent priests to Drumbow to see if anything could be done for the poor men. So you have his the letters, you can see the letters they write to their mammies then, like, you know, the last letter home. And, you know, you can't imagine, like, because that was 4 p.m. and it's going to be the next morning at the crack of dawn, yeah. they're going to be executed.
And by the time the letter got to,
yes.
the mother, they were gone.
"A Máthair Dillis, my last message to you and all at home is not to worry about my death or its circumstances. Forget all about its physical and worldly aspect and look at that only from the spiritual and religious point of view. I am now within a few short hours of death and writing you with perfect calmness. All I think of is eternity, and I'm ready to go out at 7 o'clock and face the firing squad with confidence and hope in God's great mercy for the salvation of my soul. Our bodies don't count much at this stage, and so far as our souls are concerned, we have had a splendid opportunity. Thank God to make them ready. We got the news about 4 this evening, though it was rather unexpected, because we had never lost sight of the possibility of our court-martial ending in death. Father MacMullan has been with us and heard our confessions. His kindness and encouragement has made us feel, I might say, light-hearted. We are to have Mass and Holy Communion at 6. I think that I will have the privilege and pleasure of answering Mass, as I used to long ago in Kiltalla. I won't say much about worldly affairs. They look very insignificant now, except that I am leaving all of you some souvenir or other. I will give a list of them later. My clothes and a few other things will be sent home also later on. To sum up my best wishes to you, they are your prayers for my eternal happiness, and that you and all the others at home will pray that each and every one of us will meet together in heaven. I feel that I am fortunate in going now and leaving you all behind to pray for me. I too, with the help of God and the Blessed Virgin, will pray for you until our next meeting."
The last letter from Charlie Daly to his mother outlines the events that are about to unfold.
You had priests coming into it, and the local chaplain as well, who'd always minister him. And then you can see that Bishop Donald sent other priests from Bow. So you can see in the letters written, you know, especially to mammies. Yeah, there's a religious theme on, and maybe it's to settle their mammies, yeah. or maybe to give their mammies a wee bit of comfort.
And they talk so much about life after,
yes,
death, and
that there, you know,
that was the belief at the time.
That they want that, and yeah. they give mammy comfort that they knew that they weren't scared, even though they probably were. Even though, like Charlie Daly says, that Larkin had a death wish, but he didn't. You know, he's upset, and he only got comforted after having a meeting with the priest before his execution to give him some comfort in his last hours.
And even the way they talk about, "Pray for me and I'll pray for
you."
It's like they said that the prayers will just more or less distract you from
from
not being here.
Being
as well.
Here, yeah. And then, like, you know, it's kind of like the shame of being executed as well. Like, you know, it would have serious consequences for the family as well. And yes, they had, you know, Auntie Treaty had supporters in Cork and Kerry, but it's the bigger picture for the family of having a member of the family executed as well would have serious consequences. You can see that there's also us, obviously, a priest helping to write them, because I don't know how well educated they all were, but you can see some of the words and some of the phrases used as well. It wouldn't be phrases that naturally come to anybody as well.
Through them, there's such a repetition.
Yeah, they're the same. So he maybe went from one to the other to kind of give them the same letter and to give the families and the mummies a bit of comfort and, you know, to help them through the terrible ordeal that was going to ahead of them.
Joe Sweeney was the man left in charge of arranging the executions. It was difficult for him particularly, as he had a personal connection with Charlie Daly.
Later on in 1949, Ernie O'Malley interviewed a huge amount of men involved in the conflict, and including Joe Sweeney. And Joe Sweeney said that time of the execution, he said, the terrible thing then was that Daly had to be executed because that was the law. They passed the law that, you know, anybody in possession of the arm was going to be executed. So we'd received word from Dublin that anyone captured carrying arms would be court-martialed and sentenced to death. I had to do the job myself, to order a firing party for the execution. And it was particularly difficult because Daly and I had been friendly when they were students. They were in UCD together. And it's an awful thing to kill a man in cold blood, level terms with him. Trading shots at a man in battle is one thing, but an execution is something else altogether. I wasn't present at the execution myself, but to make sure there was no foul up, the firing party were all picked men, and they were told that they were to put them out of pain as quickly as possible. At that time, he had this barber system where the provost marshal had to go along afterwards and deliver a coup de grace to the heart. I didn't agree with it, but there were orders and you had to do it. That's probably a reason why maybe he wasn't there. And when the first executions were held in Kilmainham, they were botched. And the poor men died in agony. They weren't clean kills and things like that. So it's probably only the little bit of maybe not comfort or a little bit of grace that they were going to be killed cleanly, not suffer.
Yeah.
As he said, he didn't agree, but because the officer commanding then there on the firing squad would have to go and shoot them through the heart to make sure they were dead. So if he was there, he would be the officer in charge and have to do it. You can't imagine what that, as he talks about in the terms of, like, he knew Daly.
Yeah.
You know, and he had respect because Daly was extraordinary, and he was a kind of like a professional soldier as well. Joe Sweeney had respect for him because he was an officer commanding as well. He wasn't just like a volunteer, he was a soldier.
So the time came for Charlie Daly, Timothy O'Sullivan, Dan Enright and Sean Jack Larkin to be executed. At 7 a.m. on March the 14th, 1923, the four were taken out from Drumbo Castle and executed by the firing squad. We cast our minds back to the other four men arrested along with the Drumbo martyrs and what the future held for them.
Which was Daniel Coyle, Frank and Francis Ward, James Donaghy and James Lane. On the 17th of March, they signed an undertaking which they agreed not to take up arms against the government and the army again, saving their lives. Basically, they signed, they end away being executed and saved their lives.
And were the others not offered that?
They were. We believe they were offered, right, but they were not going to be signing anything. They were to be the martyrs. It's funny. I wonder how Ethnic Coyle was Daniel Coyle's brother. And you remember Daniel Coyle was originally in the RIC. He had been in the RIC before this with his sister Ethna. You wonder what the relationship would have been like.
Yeah, quite a change of tack then.
Yeah, because she was in prison at this time. And she probably maybe thought that maybe possibly that, you know, Daniel maybe shouldn't have signed it. Or maybe said, I don't know what the relationship was like after us, because signing that, it was a big deal. You're saving your life, yes.
And you were
understandable.
Going against what you had
your principles, yes. What your principles were and what you had fought for all those years and stood for. On the 21st of March, Father McMullen, who was the army chaplain of Drumbo and the local parish priest at the time, he administered to the four before their execution and possibly helped them write their letters. And he wrote to Father Brennan, which was the parish priest of Castlemaine, which was Daly's home place. And in his letter he wrote, "They are buried in a spot where there's no traffic or danger or desecration of any kind. I feel certain that when the days dawn, as I earnestly hope they shall soon, it'll not be difficult to get permission to exhume them. The spot is dry and the coffins are good and there'll be no difficulty identifications." Because you read reports and you're saying, oh, they're thrown into a mass grave and no coffins. But no, they were treated with respect and put into individual coffins and put into, you know, a prepared grave as well.
My native home and everything in it was burned down on the night of St. Patrick's Day with considerable harshness or cruelty to the inmates as a reprisal for Drumbeau on the score that the bishops cared little how many were executed. These are the words of Bishop O'Donnell, who was targeted in the aftermath of the executions.
Believing that Bishop O'Donnell did little to intervene to help the men, his family was targeted. So he said, "I suppose the poor fellows, the arsonists, little knew that when news of the imminence of the Drumbeau execution reached me late the evening before, I managed after hours to make telegraphic communication to Dublin. I sent the most earnest representations against the execution." So later then, when Tim Healy, who was now the Governor General, sympathised with him on the burning of his home, he lost all his possessions. I think his brother is still living there, and they were turfed out of the house before it was burnt. O'Donnell could not conceal his disapproval of the executions. He said, "The burning of my native home," he replied to Healy, "is indeed a bad business, but in my opinion, the executions of Drumbeau, for which it was a reprisal, should not, to say the very least, have taken place." So he made it in no certain terms that he didn't agree with the policy of executions at the time. At the time, the policy of executions, so the threat was there, so they were held like native hostages. Aftermath then in Drumbeau, you know, there were still men being court-martialed, and the threat of the execution was there, but it didn't carry out anymore in Donegal, but the threat was still there, and it was to kind of stop the violence, to cut it out at once and make sure there was no other attacks.
And it's ironic then, because they weren't responsible for the Creeslaw attack, that, you know, it didn't really stop those that were responsible.
No, it didn't. But we don't know who was responsible for the Creeslaw, because as Father Donald says, they believe none of their men were in the area. So then it's a version then that there was just local general lawlessness and rowdiness as well too. So we'll never know, unfortunately, who attacked the barrage. And unfortunately, Captain Cannon was killed. We had then another reprisal was Boney Glen House in South Donegal. And it was burnt to reprisal. And that was the home of Mr. and Mrs. Sinclair. He was a British diplomat. I think he was in Pennsylvania at the time, or Bermuda. But the unfortunate thing was that Mrs. Sinclair, she was a powerhouse in that marriage. Prior to this, she organised classes to qualify women in handicrafts, and she also got them work. She tried to better the local women to get their own independent income. Like, she was a powerhouse in the marriage, and she was also a forefront of the women's rights as well.
In the following months, much would change in Ireland. Unrest after many years would begin to fade out.
Eventually, on May the 24th, 1922, De Valera and Aiken declared a truce, ordered the men to lay down their arms. So the Civil War petered out or came to an end. But as we know, over the decades then, the bitterness and division that it caused was a factor, you know, a factor we can see in the political parties, and we can see, you know, until the kind of the current government, that, you know, there were still political both sides, the enemies on the both sides, you're one or the other, you know, it's still talked about, you know, what party you are. But now, because they're in government now together, along the Green Party, that it's a change in politics in Ireland for good. Following the cessation of hostilities in May 1923, when all anti-treaty forces were ordered by the HQ to dump arms and return home, a demand began then to hand over the remains of all those who executed in Ireland. And in August 1924, there was an order to evacuate the HQ at Drumbeau Castle and move it to Finner Camp. So we know from work records and worksheets that between the work party sheets, between the 25th and the 28th of August, the bodies were all exhumed and transported to the barracks in Athlone to be reinterred there. In 1924 then, it was announced that the government were to release all the bodies of all those executed during the Civil War, and they kind of released them in stages as well, rather than one day. In Athlone then, on 28th of October, the bodies of those executed in Drumbeau were handed over to the families to be returned home to be buried in their home counties. So we know then by September 1923, 81 men had been executed, 77 anti-treaty forces and four others were executed at this stage, and thousands of men and women were in prison or interred at this stage. So by 1935 then, a fundraising committee was set up to erect a memorial, and fundraising was carried out in Ireland and America. Then on Easter Sunday, in front of lots of, we have a fantastic photograph of the relatives gathering in front of the Celtic Cross, the work of John Daly, memorial sculpture in Letterkenny, and it was unveiled in the field. It appeared to be the size of their executions, but more than likely they were executed in the walled garden. It's there to be seen, for it's still there.
And through the commemorations this year, yes, like the people coming out and the support, like it was always republicanism, and but
yeah,
it's changed from that now.
As we're a century on now, we're in a better position to explore the fullness of the history of the Decade of Centenaries period, and we can do so with courage and a sense of inclusiveness. And we also have an opportunity to construct a future for all those who want to call this island home, with their diverse histories and memories, all to be respectfully considered. And in the process of this ethical remembering, the reflections we've made throughout this decade of centenaries can help us all in our journey together towards a shared future that is marked by inclusivity, diversity, possibilities and a sharing of memories and condition of peace in a diverse country that we can be all proud of.
And I think they've really become the Drumbo martyrs rather than being associated with their anti-treaty efforts.
Yeah.
You know, three people getting to know the story.
They do. And the Drumbo martyrs phrase, I think, only came about in the... it was just first mentioned about them, I think, maybe in around the time in the 1930s, around the time of the fundraising campaign. They hadn't a name before that. They were the executed men. It's another part of our decade of centenaries commemorations. And, you know, there's lots of different events from when we started in 2012 to the Ulster Covenant. And, you know, this is history. It's happened. We can't change it, no matter how much we want to change things. It's there. And it's there, hopefully, that we can learn from it. You know, it's to tell us what has gone on before. And hopefully we don't repeat it. But unfortunately, we know, even with all the history we have, it repeats itself. You know, things don't change, really.
And I think remembering the people themselves and their families, even through having these letters,
it's they're human. They're, yes. they're not these soldiers or martyrs. They're men, or young men. They're actually young men, you know, and they weren't married. You know, they left behind their mammies and their brothers and sisters and their daddies and their relatives, but they were very young men. And, like, you can see their connection to their mummies.
Yeah, and everyone addressed their mum.
Their mummies, their last letters, their main last letter home were their mummies.
And I love the way they sign off, more or less the same, that, you know, until we meet again.
Yes, and that's what they hoped for, and that's what they believed in at the time. That's the hope they give their mummies as well.
That concludes this four-part series to mark the decade of centenaries in conjunction with the Donegal County Museum. You can listen back to all episodes in the playback section of highlandradio.com. My thanks to Caroline Carr, Judith McCarthy and Niamh Brennan for sharing their wealth of knowledge on Donegal's history. This podcast series was funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media under the Community Strand of the 2023 Decade of Centenaries programme as part of the Decade of Centenaries Initiative 2012 to 2023.